Full Circle Podcast on Hacker Public Radio. In this episode, Og Camp 11 Discussion Panel. Hello world, and welcome to the Full Circle Podcast on Hacker Public Radio. This is the third of our highlights of last summer's unconference, Og Camp 11, held at the Farnham Maltings in the south of England.
The Full Circle Podcast is the companion to Full Circle Magazine, the independent magazine for the Ubuntu community. Find us at fullcirclemagazine.org/podcast.
Introducing the Og Camp 11 panel discussion. On the panel we have Dan Lynch of Linux Outlaws, our chairman, Karen Sandler of the GNOME Foundation and ex of the Freedom Software Law Center, Simon Phipps of ForgeRock and the Open Software Initiative, Stuart Ack Langridge from Canonical's Ubuntu One team and ex Lug Radio presenter, and finally Fabian Scherschel, presenter of Linux Outlaws. Like every good panel discussion, this all begins with questions from the floor.
All right, so I've done the ultimate lazy thing of decided to try and get user-generated content, which, you know, relies on you guys a lot. So we've got a fabulous panel of people here, and I've got some ideas and topics that we can discuss and stuff, but we really want you guys to ask questions, you know, how often do you get a chance to ask these people questions and so on, and we can discuss them and all that kind of stuff. So let me introduce you to the panel. So to my left here, we have Karen Sandler, who did a great talk earlier. She's the executive director of the GNOME Foundation and a former lawyer. Are you still a lawyer?
I'm still a lawyer.
Into the mic a bit.
I'm still a lawyer. I'm still doing pro bono work with the Software Freedom Law Center and some for the Software Freedom Conservancy, and I'm general counsel of Question Copyright still.
Wow, okay, so legal questions for Karen then.
Don't ask legal questions, they're always really boring.
Right. Okay. As you will have to say, this is not legal advice.
This does not constitute legal advice.
I don't think she has to in this country.
Maybe not. Okay, so obviously, you probably all saw Simon's talk before. So we've got Simon Phipps from OSI. We've also got Mr. Stuart Langridge from Canonical. I believe you're working on Ubuntu One and all that mostly.
Yeah.
And some guy on the end who does a podcast or something. I don't know who he is, but he seems to have worked his way up. But yeah, we've got Fab as well. So if anybody's got any questions as we go, please chip in, because otherwise I'm just going to be sat here going... So the first kind of topic that I wanted to discuss, and I've asked the guys about this because I knew it could be a bit controversial and stuff, but I should also point out these people are representing themselves and not their companies and so on. So before Ack gets in trouble or anything else, not that you need my help to get in trouble. yeah, we've got to make that clear. But yeah, something I wanted to kind of talk about is the future of the desktop, I suppose. I know it sounds like an old subject and stuff, but the future of the Linux desktop as I see it. Because obviously we've got GNOME 3 just come out. And that's kind of developing. Fab's wearing the GNOME 3 shirt. Yeah, and we've got KE4 still going strong. We've got all these other options and stuff. But I want to try to get people's opinions. I mean, Simon talked earlier about making compromises and so on, and using the Mac and stuff. So I want to ask you a little bit about what you feel is better, maybe about the Mac interface and stuff like that. So I don't know.
That's not actually relevant to the issue, to be honest with you.
Well, fair enough. That's a good point. I can see I'm in trouble here. should have got a lasso. Really go for the cowboy metaphor. All right. And so let's kick this off with, I don't know, I'm going to pick on Karen, I apologize, but what do you think the future of the Linux desktop is? Obviously GNOME 3.
Yeah, I mean, GNOME 3 is one of the reasons why I decided to go over to GNOME. So I've only been at the GNOME Foundation for like a little bit over a month now. So it's all still pretty new for me, but one of the reasons why I found the job so appealing is that GNOME 3 is really a departure and something new. Mm-hmm. And I think that with a redesign like GNOME 3 has, you know, we can really reach a lot more people. I mean, it's still early days, but you can sort of see going forward where this is going. And I think that that's really amazing.
Mm. I mean, do you think in some ways that obviously GNOME 3, it's, as you say, it's a big change. And we had all the kind of teething troubles with KV4. Do you think that's happening a little bit with GNOME 3 now? You kind of feel your way into it?
Well, what Linus Torvalds has been saying. I think there will be. Any time you do something different and you make a departure, you try something new, you can't make everybody happy all the time. And since GNOME 3 is new, it's going to take some time for people to get used to, and some people are going to decide not to use it. I hope that more people do decide to use it. And I think part of the point of the GNOME 3 redesign was to reach less technical users. Although I do know a lot of highly technical users have been happy with GNOME 3. I was just talking to Fab about this on an interview that he's a GNOME 3 user.
I hope you're not implying that I'm highly technical.
That's true. But no, I know a bunch of hackers who are really using GNOME 3 for development. So I think that's pretty cool. But as I said, some things are still new. There are still kinks to work out, and I think even with that being said, we're going to be in a similar situation where Linus moved to GNOME after he was frustrated with KDE. So I think this is one of the things that we're just going to see and we're going to have to live with and hope that we can improve and learn from.
Okay, so that sounds to me like it's one of the great things. I think it's kind of like a double-edged sword. We have a lot of choices, but at the same time, does that divide the development and the resources and stuff? I don't know. Simon, what's your favorite Linux desktop and what do you think about it?
At the moment, I'm in love with my Honeycomb tablet.
Okay.
So I think the future of the Linux desktop is the tablet.
Future of the Linux tablet.
it's interesting here. I think that the Linux has had its chance to be on the desktop, and it's done a damn good job of being on the desktop for a lot of people, but unfortunately the desktop is going away. So Linux may well become even more popular on the desktop, but by percentage the number of people using a desktop is going to go way down, and most people will be interacting with Linux through some other interface.
How much of an interactive panel do you want this to be? Are you interviewing us?
As much as possible.
Mano.
I was going to say that I agree with you that the way that we're computing has changed, but I think that it's very sensational to say that the desktop is going away. Yeah. I think anyone who needs to generate content of any kind or wants to sit in for a really long amount of computer use where, I think we'll want to sit in a comfortable seat with a big screen and a comfortable, a keyboard or some other way of inputting. And I think that it's a little bit sensational to say the desktop. I mean, it's changing, and the way that our devices interact with each other, and maybe we're going towards modular things. But I still think the desktop is an important and long term.
Well, maybe, but we're in a really exciting time where there's more choice than just things that are designed to be really complicated desktop systems. So we've got Chrome OS coming, where your desktop is going to be a browser. We've got Honeycomb, where your desktop is a haptic surface. We've got KDE and GNOME busy doing the traditional stuff. We've got Microsoft failing to innovate in it at all. We've got Apple on the verge of turning actively evil. There's all this new stuff happening on there, and I think that believing that the future of the desktop has got to be like the history of the desktop, I think is the problem. Because I think there's going to be a whole lot of people whose only experience of a computer is going to be through a Chrome browser soon. Mm. And there's going to be a whole lot of people whose only experience of a computer is going to be through a haptic tablet screen that's this big and probably has got a keyboard you can often associate with it when you need it. And I think that all of these options, and the thing that really excites me about them is so many of them have got free software underneath them or within them, and the software freedom is preserved for the user. And I think that is what's fantastic about what's going on.
Mm. I'm conscious I don't want to leave the other guys out. So
yes.
So Ak, what's your feelings on the future of the Linux interface?
It's interesting what Simon says, that the idea of software freedom is best embodied by turning my computer into a dumb terminal and having Google own all of my data. Thanks a lot for that.
So what exactly is it would you want?
It's not me who's saying that software freedom is the defining characteristic of this thing. The other thing I think is interesting is when you say Microsoft haven't innovated in any way, it's me defending Microsoft, you really? I've used Windows.
That might have been hyperbolic, but I don't know with you.
The last bit of that was right, I think. It's... I've used Windows Phone 7, and I think it's quite good. Now, I have no intention of using it on a phone, because it requires the rest of the Microsoft stack, which I don't have. It requires me to have an Exchange server. I can't write software for it on Ubuntu, whatever. Not interesting. But What they've actually done, which I thought was interesting, is genuinely innovated. Android, much as I use it every day, and Honeycomb's good and everything, it's hard to make the case that it's not a flagrant rip-off of iOS. Windows Phone 7 is genuinely different. I think it's genuinely innovative. No one gives a shit. But they've actually sat there and gone, let's build a great phone system. No one's going to use it because they've missed the boat. But Microsoft are now in the position that we've always been in, that we can come up with innovations, but nobody listens. What I think is interesting is, when we talk about the future of the free desktop, or the future of the Linux desktop, or whatever, the problem is not doing technical innovation, because we're actually quite good at that. The problem is, how do we get people to pay attention?
Yes. And I think that's the critical question to ask, because I think that, I interviewed the guys who were working on WebOS for Hewlett Packard when I was over at OSCON last week. And they've got some fantastic technology. I mean, that WebOS, it's awesome. You know, it's like HTML desktop, they're using Node.js for the system services. You can write system applications in JavaScript. The thing is awesome. But the problem they've got is that to get to market, they've got to leverage some sort of ecosystem. And they've decided they're going to be HTTP only. So, ooh, goodbye WebOS. And this is the problem that I think we've got to face when it comes to the software freedom dimension, which is we've got all the people in this room persuaded. We haven't got all the rest of their families persuaded, and we haven't worked out how we're going to do that yet.
I was going to give Fab a chance to talk, but Well, I'm sure that won't last too long. Sorry, mate, I'll give just a second. Andy wants to make a point about something. So if you've got a point, by the way, and you want to say anything, just shoot your hand up and someone will bring you a mic eventually.
Hello, I've got the mic, yes. I think it's on. I might be wrong. Anyway, so a couple of interesting things. I was just stunned by some of the things, and I was attempting to tweet them, there were some connectivity issues. So, Simon, to say that Microsoft isn't innovating at all is just bizarre when they're the only company with Kinect, and Windows Phone 7 is,
which,
as Simon says,
I think they're bored, right? They bought a company which was innovating, and now they have Kinect.
Yes.
So, but there's some amazing things that could happen out of those kind of technologies. Stuart was mentioning Google and, you know, making the desktop a dumb terminal, having everything owned in the cloud. Well, you know, okay, you could do personal clouds at home, but then you come back to the WebOS. Well, that's exactly, I mean, HTML5 desktop, you still got stuff in the web, you know, on the cloud, in the interweb somewhere. So I just find some of the viewpoints that I'm hearing can't quite.
I should be clear here, I think storing stuff in the cloud is brilliant.
You can't have to do that.
Just to be clear about this, I think it's a great idea. I don't have a problem with it at all. I just find it interesting to hear Simon talk about software freedom and storing everything on someone else's servers in the same breath.
So we've got a challenge of working out what software freedom means in the cloud, I think. And that, the great question is, how are we going to project those principles into the cloud? And I think the answer has got to have a lot to do with federated software. I don't think there's any problem with the cloud. What I have a problem with is all of my identity and data being under the control of somebody whose only relationship with me is a terms of service I don't have the time to read. And I think that I'm very keen to get off. I don't want to get off Google. What I want to do is I want to get on something that's federated with Google, so that on the days they're evil, which is alternate Tuesdays, I can flick a switch and I'm using my federated service instead of their centralized service. That's where I think, the sort of place I think we've got to go to.
Okay, so Fab, you
asking myself, I'm really scared, and this is interesting because I love Android, I've been an Android user for a long time. I'm really scared that if the desktop's dead and Android is our future on computers, Android is barely free software, and in some cases, as in cases of Honeycomb, it's not even open source yet, apparently. I don't know. That kind of really scares me. If the desktop is dead, we have lost. Because I think it's awesome to talk about, yeah, we're in federated cloud services, but the reality is all these companies, they have no interest in doing that. Google has no interest whatsoever in federating with anybody, because they make their money from owning all of your data.
Well, I think that's kind of comparable to the argument that DRM, that going without DRM was not in the interest of any companies, but because music buyers and the public were choosing to go with server, you know, with services that didn't have DRM, than you know Apple had to. You know, the key DRM users had to shift away from it, that we as consumers really have a lot of say in this if we act with our money.
I don't think actually that Google wants to have all your data. I think they just want to have handled it once.
Which is what the data portability stuff is about, they're running on. Yeah, I'm sure you can get your data in and out of Google stuff.
Yeah, that was sort of her problem. Yeah, I mean, I use Google for just about everything. And I'm very vocal on saying I'm not really scared about it because I don't think Google wants my data. They want an aggregate of all our data. They don't want to sell me specifically. I mean, they're not like sending me emails. Hey, Fab, you like ads? Do you want to buy this hat? Right? They try to get aggregate stuff, but that's just as long as they're doing that. I mean, at the point where they have my data, they could decide tomorrow or next Tuesday that they're evil.
Yeah. Okay. Right. We've got a couple of points from the crowd here. So we've got a gentleman here.
I'm another one that doesn't think my desktop's dead just yet. One of the things that I do worry a bit about is the kind of death by dog fooding I'm seeing. We're all using these kind of, I'm using Unity, GNOME 3. They're making use of a lot of metadata that we're putting in, and it's getting history over time and making things a lot more relevant, which is awesome for us. But when my girlfriend uses it for the first time, it doesn't have a metadata, it doesn't have a history, and everything is really hard to discover. I mean, how do we address that? Because when she goes in and starts looking to see what apps are there, it's a really complicated process. When she gets back the next day after using a few, she can see her favorite apps.
Okay, so the question there seems to be, how do we address that, which is a hell of a question. So who wants to try and tackle that one? I'm going to pick on someone if you don't want to.
I think we can do that. I think Eck can do that. I think the cloud is actually the answer to that.
Yes.
At the point where we get a free cloud, where we can are in control of our data, we can put this data in the cloud and then share that out. Like if we get a new machine, and do that.
Right. Actually, it isn't. My concern isn't that we can make that happen, because I actually think Google can already do a really good job of solving that problem for you, because they've been watching your girlfriend for quite some time now, and they know quite a lot about her. They know my wife pretty well as well. The problem isn't that. The problem is what you do when you don't want them to know what you're doing. All these old-fashioned technologies that aren't aware of the people who are using them, they're going to go away. We'll only be using technologies that are aware of the context in which they're performing fairly soon. Mm. And the question is, who's going to provide that context and on what terms? And I think that's the reason why Google wants to touch all your data as it passes through their servers. They don't want to own it. They just want to have been loaned it for a few moments. And the real question is, what are they going to do with that experience? And are you going to get to decide what they use it for? That's the real concern about all the metadata.
But that's exactly the point. You come back to the fact that I want things to be personal to me. I don't want to use a system which is identical for everybody. I want it to adapt to what I do, to work with what I think, to work exactly the way I want. And to be honest with you, I'm quite happy to outsource working all our stuff out to someone else because I can't be bothered. Well, so some people are not like that. Some people will absolutely think, no. I don't want any third party. I don't want any company making those decisions for me. I want to make it all myself. I'm prepared for it to be harder for me. I'm prepared for there to be less customization. I'm prepared to have to do more setting up. I'm prepared to have to tweak things myself. And that's fine. You're absolutely at liberty to do that. We want to avoid a situation where you are unable to make that choice, but I think we're doing a reasonable job of avoiding that. No one's obliged to use Google. Everyone chooses to because it's good.
Well, I think people don't really realize that there's a connection between targeted advertising and an integrated experience and surveillance. And I think we started to talk about it more, and I know that this is one of the things that Mozilla is trying to do with Do Not Track, and there have been government issues in the United States and elsewhere about trying to raise awareness about this, but for me, the most important thing is to make these choices very clear and very active as soon as you start using anything, and making it clear and ongoing, because right now, I don't see ads, so, I don't really, but those people tell me that they want to see ads, and not only do they want to see ads, they want to see really targeted ads. And to me, that's crazy, but they never think about the implications societally. They never think about the fact that if we do facial recognition, for example, and train our photos and train Facebook, then, we're going to be able to publish a picture of a protest and have a government be able to identify everyone who's there. It's very easy to draw those connections, but it's not something we're thinking about, and we don't have choices right from the beginning.
Yeah. It's all about building up a fabric of trust as well. So most of us have got an experience of Google that means that we've got a fabric of trust that means we don't think they're going to abuse the data they've got. Whereas yesterday on Facebook, I found that by agreeing to have it sync contacts, which I thought meant add my friends' phone numbers to my address book on my phone, Facebook were actually sucking my entire contact list out of my phone and storing it on Facebook for future use. That means that I've got a very fragmented fabric of trust with Facebook, which is a whole lot worse than it was before. And I think that, that overall the key here is the transparency by the service provider and the ability for us to make conscious choices. I think that the big threat is unconscious choices or choices that are made for us. I think it's exactly the same discussion that Karen and I were having after I did my talk.
Okay, I'm afraid I'm going to cut in because I'm very good at bringing people in here. So we've got a gentleman there with the mic wants to say something. You can change the topic as well, by the way. We don't have to keep discussing Google. So
this was from a little bit earlier in the conversation. The cloud is surely less of an issue for software freedom and more of an issue for data freedom, which we have touched on with data portability. I don't want Google software. I want my data so I can stick it into Amazon software or my own. And don't we need principles for data freedom as well as software freedom? And are they different?
Well, if you have software freedom in the cloud, if you have an AGPL piece of software that you can run yourself, I think the point is that you have the choice then to run it yourself. I think it comes with...
As long as you have Google's data center.
That doesn't buy you anything. That's completely useless to you. The fact that I can say, okay, I can store my data on Google.com, or I can run their software on my own server, still doesn't mean I've got data portability at all.
But at least you know what they're doing with the data. You can look at the software. You know that's real.
That's
That's actually part of the battle, I think, is knowing how screwed you are. But I disagree that's actually the answer, I'm afraid, fact.
Okay, so we've got a gentleman in the red shirt there who wants to make
a comment. Yeah, I'm going to go back to a comment you made earlier on about the fear of Android. And I think that's absolutely the problem. That is where it's going. And open source needs to get into that space so we don't have that fear. And the whole free software part of it is that if we allow that to be owned by the proprietary vendors who are coming out of it.
Okay. So, as I say, if anyone's got any more comments, I think someone there, just at the stairs. Sorry, it's all a bit of a free-for-all. So, as I said, if you've got any other topics you want to discuss as well, don't feel free to bring them. It doesn't have to be free software related. Okay, here we go.
So, if the desktop is dying, we're all going to tablets. How many of you reckon that Intel will be dead outside the server room in a few years?
Interesting question. Well, how many of you here have got tablets? I mean, Simon's got one. Fab, you've got one now. I haven't got one. I can't afford one. Have you got a tablet computer? Have you got a tablet?
No.
So there you go. So the majority of the people on this stage have not got a tablet.
And I have.
Yeah, how many people in the audience have got a tablet computer? Okay, so
keep in mind that
he's got two. He's got two. Everyone follow that guy on the way out. No, I didn't say that.
I don't think it's the answer. I have a tablet, and it's not the answer. Like, unless they invent some kind of glass that's not affected by finger smudges.
The place where it's important is that what the tablet does, it means you've probably got two devices in your life, and you're no longer satisfied with your data only being on one of them. Because you probably want whichever device happens to be the one in front of you to be the one that knows about you and can help you. And I think that's the radical difference that having tablets makes. And that this was the huge difference that the iPad made for a lot of people, was they suddenly discovered that the computer with the chair in front of it and the mouse wasn't the only place they could do stuff. And that was an awakening that just changed the way that things were going to work. So I think that it isn't about doing everything on the tablet, it's about that once you realise that tablets are actually not just something for your kids to draw on in chalk, you discover a world where the desktop isn't the only thing you're going to use, and then you begin to ask questions about, well, what else could I do somewhere other than in that chair, in an office? And that's the revolution that happens.
But the thing is, you don't have to use a proprietary service to have, you know, cloud storage. I mean, there are other things. I know they're not really up to speed at the moment, but there are things like SparkleShare that have got promise. But at the same time, there seems to be about 10 different projects all competing to be the same thing. And I know I might have some things on this because you've kind of competed in the same field. They're all trying to make an Android app. They're all trying to make an iPhone app. They're all trying to be everywhere and do everything. But are they going to succeed when you've got someone like Google who've already got all of this space, you've got Amazon who are massive in this space as well. People know those names, will they give someone else a try? I'm going to aim this at Ash, because I know you're in this field.
Okay, I can talk a little bit about the cloud stuff, but speaking as someone who works for Ubuntu One is therefore competitor in these things, I think people's partnership stuff are great. What worries me, a more general point there, is precisely that there are 10, in the same way that there are 10 video editors and so on. And a bunch of people will say, no, because that's because it's about choice and it's important. But equally, what we end up with is everything being unfinished. And this, to my mind, plays back into a word Simon used earlier, which is trust. One of the things I don't like, looking at things like the GNOME 3 shell launch, you had a bunch of people complaining bitterly about how stuff had changed and it wasn't right. We had exactly the same thing with Unity. And you get a lot of that. It's about trusting the GNOME developers. It's about trusting the Ubuntu team to do things right. And we don't have that. We don't have that sense of trust. Everyone seems to think that, no, they know better than the people who are actually doing this. And what it means is we end up eating our own yum. You know, we've got, there's an example of this guy called Jonathan Blow, I think his name is, going to be Braid. Is that his name? Yeah. He, professional game developer, right, decided he was going to port Braid to Linux. And so posted on his website saying, I want to do this, but I've never used Linux before, so I need to know how to do a bunch of simple game things, like how do I change the mouse acceleration, how do I trap the mouse in a box, how do I play one sound and then play another sound on top of it at the same time and mix them up and down. Just simple stuff that you need to write a game. And he got 342 different answers from people saying, you need to use OpenAL, no, you need to use ALSA, no, you need to use RSS4. And everyone hated everyone else and denigrated all of the other answers. And in the end he said, you know what, the hell with this. If you guys can't get it together and come up with an answer, why the hell should we pay attention? And I think a lot of that's because we don't trust the people who are doing something to do it right. Everyone thinks, I know better, I'll do a different one.
Mm. Yep. Yeah, but at the same time, that's the freedom that we have in being able to do that. I mean, the alternative is what, everybody use DirectX or something, and that is the way we go.
The alternative is Apple, where you have a lot of users that absolutely, totally trust Steve Jobs, love everything he does, and just love that. And I, as somebody who doesn't, I hate that.
Which is fine, but then, okay, so the question then becomes, is it possible, is it reasonable that this massive variety of unfinished stuff, we have the choice to choose any of these unfinished things, is actually going to get us the success that we'd like? I think, I'm not sure about that, maybe, maybe not. But it's quite possible to think, okay, perhaps the future of Linux is us. We're not going to get into the mainstream because we think choice is more important.
I've changed my mind on that quite over the years. I think you're probably right. I think Linux is probably not the future of everybody, every user on the desktop. And I actually think we should embrace that, and we would be better in some ways if we figured out that we don't get all the people to use it.
But I think, I mean, just going back to my talk from earlier, I think we as like a society are going to be kind of screwed if we don't move towards free and open source software solutions and free and open platforms, because this is all like life and society critical stuff. It's not like, I mean, this is basically how we're living our lives and how we're doing it together. So while I think that, you know, it's right that to some extent we as technically oriented people are going to be the ones driving this stuff forward, I think it would be a mistake if we just said we should embrace that and limit ourselves and not look to the outside, not look to everyone. I mean, that's one of the things Canonical is trying to do is bring GNU Linux more to the everyday person. Yeah. And I really support that. But I would actually say that one of the ways that we can handle this trust issue is to focus a lot on nonprofit development. You know, help. I mean, I'm coming from GNOME, so I'm a little biased, but I mean, I'm dedicated. I make considerably less money now than I did in the private sector, and it's well worth it because I'm working on something I care about, and if we all kind of work together, it's a way to bring disparate companies into one decision-making body, and I think that's really valuable.
This is just a comment to the point where the discussion has reached right now, when somebody mentioned the word success, and it dawned on me that, well, do you absolutely want freedom of choice or cost or success. The two are not necessarily and automatic and all the time compatible, so you have to decide which way you're going. An absolute compromise between the two is not necessarily always possible. So it depends what is your main priority. Coming back to the cloud discussion earlier on, I have to say that I am seriously concerned by the fact that a lot of open source people and freedom sort of advocates seem to be embracing the current cloud movement quite wholeheartedly, without what I feel is enough questioning of the openness of the entire concept. Very few people seem to be asking, well, am I allowed to, and can I write an APK client application which will talk to such and such cloud services? Well, no, because actually they use, in most circumstances, a proprietary protocol which we don't know about and we don't understand, and they won't really let you write software that just plugs into different cloud services. So as far as I'm concerned, really, at protocol level and the data format level, there's a massive amount of incompatibility and closeness about it, which I think should be really concerning.
This brings up a question in my mind, and I'm going to spring this about. Can I write a client for Ubuntu One myself?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's all documented.
Absolutely, you can. Yeah? There are two bits to Ubuntu One, data and files. Okay. The data stuff is all couched in bed. Apache project already exists. Perfectly reasonable thing to use. The file stuff, we use a binary protocol to talk to our file servers just because it's quicker, basically. It's essentially compression, but it's all documented and the clients are all open source.
Clients are open source, but the server end isn't, though, is it?
Correct.
Okay. I just wanted to kind of clarify that a little bit. So I think Alistair, you had your hand up quite a lot as well, so we need to kind of get more questions. If you've got other topics and stuff as well, you can bring them up so far away.
We were just trying to define success for Linux and open source systems. My definition of success is it works for me, and I don't really mind too much how many other people use it as long as it works for me. And so I think that's how we should define our success. The other thing I wanted to bring up is this whole idea of how do we get it onto more people's standard everyday machine. Is it just that we're being too nice about it? Shouldn't we be getting a bit more in people's face about the ideas?
Okay.
Computer Liberation Front. We're here to liberate your computer.
Power to the people.
This is part of why I realized that I had to start talking about my heart condition. Even though it's not something that I would have typically wanted to have said in a public place, that I have a heart defect. But I think thinking about the fact that my life counts on this software and it's not being reviewed and that I can't even see the software that's in my body sort of like takes these issues to an emotional place, but also one of those critical places. And I think that discussions like this about where we're going to count on our software, so like we can see it in those situations. In the United States, when we had problems with the Diebold voting machines, when you start to see how we count on our software, you sort of understand why it needs to be safer and why it needs to be reviewed. And software freedom is an essential component of that. So I actually think there's a really, real strong bit of advocacy here. And everybody in this room who's here because they care about these issues needs to start talking about it. And so I think we should get in people's spaces, but not necessarily in an aggressive, negative way, just in a, we want our software to be safe and we should start choosing solutions that are.
Okay, I think Toby wants to...
Yeah, I want to come back to a point that was made earlier about whether this is for us or for everyone, for nerds or just the average person. And it alarms me, the idea that the free software should be just for the enlightened like us. My four-year-old son uses free software. He uses Tux Paint. He absolutely loves it. He can print something and use up all the ink in my printer, very capable using Linux. And I would not want him to be deprived from having the opportunity to use free software. And if we only went down the road of nerds only, everyone else can keep out, then I don't want to be a part of it.
Which is it? Exactly how I feel. My dad runs Ubuntu. I know your mum does.
No.
And my dad's absolutely fine with it. Loves it to bits, doesn't have a problem with it. I don't want it to be just for us either. But then that comes exactly back to the point that if the notion of freedom of choice being the all-trumping most important thing is limiting it to just us, then how much of that, if any, are we prepared to sacrifice in order that my dad can use it? Some people may say I'm not prepared to sacrifice anything, and if that means that only nerds use Linux, I'm fine with that.
I don't think it's a nerd geek other people issue. I think when I said we have to figure out that we can't get everybody to use it, what I mean is, for example, my parents, technical level about the same for both of them. My father uses Windows, my mother uses Fedora, actually. And my father just doesn't use Linux because he doesn't care. Like, people have different... people care about different things. There are people who don't care about freedom of choice. And there are people who don't care about their data being free, and other people do. And they don't necessarily have to be geeks. They're just non-geeks that care about...
pretty heavily correlated.
I don't really think so. Like, for example, my mother, she's much like me. If you give her a match, it would drive her insane that you can't drag the bar at the top somewhere else, or that she can't change stuff. And she's not a geek. She just wants to have control over how she uses her computer.
Mm. Okay, so we got another point there from John.
Just to go back to the success or failure question, one of the things that was mentioned earlier was that the desktop may go away and be replaced by an ice big screen with a keyboard that you can pair up optionally and you can sit in front of your big screen and use that. Why will that work this time? Because I've got a couple of web TV boxes sitting up in my loft, and it didn't work when everybody's applications were on the cloud. I've got a Prestel box, and it didn't work when everybody's applications were going to be on the node 20 odd years ago. Why is it going to be different this time around?
Well, okay. Who wants to tackle that one? Why is it going to be different this time? Go on then.
I don't think that the problem is that it didn't work last time. We tend to swing from centralizing everything for efficiency, and then someone says, no, we should decentralize it because it's cool. And then people say, but there's a benefit to centralizing. So you had mainframes, which had nothing but dumb terminals, and everyone went, I'll tell you what we actually want to do. We want people to run applications on a computer, on their desk, and then try and move everything back to the web again. So it's just, every time you're in one of these positions, using centralized apps, you can see the benefits of decentralization. So we went through a stage of lots of stuff being on the web, and now we're starting to see processing getting pushed out to your browser again. This is what a lot of the stuff in HTML5 is about allowing work to happen out at the dumb terminal level. And I'm sure 5 or 6 years from now, someone will come up with some new damn centralized thing, and we'll all start flocking to that again. It's just the way the industry works. I don't think those things failed so much as they were overtaken by a new paradigm.
Inadequately.
Okay,
successful.
I think Simon
wants to say there's Prestel and there was Web TV, so this is the third time?
Yeah.
You know things succeed the third time, right?
Third time, look.
I'm not sure that's been new to it, the war of the universe.
Unfortunately, the mic's moved, so I'm afraid.
There is actually an interesting effect that you discover, which is once something has gone really wrong publicly a couple of times, the people who attempt it the next time learn from those mistakes. And I think what we're going to see this time is not so much a dedicated big screen whose only role in life is to sit there being the place that the big eye looks at you from, but rather that one of your alternatives is going to be to plug something or connect to something so that the environment that you're using is now shareable with lots of people or is on a bigger screen. I'm already kind of in that space. You know, I've got a really big screen on my desk. I have a tiny little screen in the bag down here. And I've got all the same phones on because I'm using free software and because I'm using web-hosted services to hold the data. And I think that's the reason it's going to work this time, is that it isn't just about being the one big screen. It's about being part of an environment where there's shared data that's a compromise between centralized and localized.
Okay.
Yeah, Prestel was pretty successful.
But yeah, I like my Prestel box. And my Minitel was great.
OggCamp is a joint venture organised by those lovely podcasters from the Linux Outlaws and Ubuntu UK podcast. With more highlights of OggCamp coming up on the Full Circle podcast very soon, including Andy Piper and Laura Tchaikovsky. For now, I'm Robin Catling. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.